This is KERA News. I'm Hadi Mawagdi. Today we're going to talk about a new book called All Over the Map, True Heroes of Texas Music. Today we're in the studio with the author, Michael Corcoran. Michael, thanks so much.
How you doing, Hadi?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you taking the time to meet with me here in Austin.
It's cool. I'm always happy to talk about this.
Well, I think we should kind of get things started off here by just learning a little bit about this book. It came out once before, and now this is the second edition.
Yeah, it originally came out in 2005. And it was a collection of about 30 newspaper articles that I wrote. Started off with the Dallas Morning News and the Austin Chronicle and the Austin American Statesman. And it was sort of, you know, at that point in my career, I was working full-time at the Statesman. It was sort of something I did on the side. And it was sort of rushed. I was just happy to have a book. You know, you're just excited. It's like, oh, now I'm a real writer. I got a book. But when it came out, I was so happy about having a book. I didn't notice certain things about it that kind of bugged me through the years, like, I wanted the cover to be a map of Texas, and they had a street map of Austin, and I got pictures for every chapter. I had a picture for each chapter, and they put them all together in a section near the front of the book. Certain things like that, and it just kind of bothered me that it was sort of like half-assed all the way around, not just for me, but other people involved. It just wasn't, like the hardcover copy didn't even have a dust jacket. It was just, you know, blank. So anyway, through those years, too, I started becoming more into research. Back then when I was working for the paper, you know, you'd have to go, say, do a review of Sarah McLachlan concert and then, you know, write about Janet Jackson's new album or something like that. And then you might be able to get a little bit of research done. But in the last, I'd say, 10 years, I've been strictly doing research on music history. And so along the way, I've learned so much that I didn't know the first time around. Certain basic things like Texas was the first state in the Union to have large populations of both African-Americans and Mexican-Americans. And that's something that's really important to know when you think about the guitar. You know, the Mexicans brought the guitars to Texas, and they taught the people in the fields, you know, blacks, whites, you know, everybody how to play guitar. And so there's a different style in the guitar. This, what you hear like in Floyd Tillman or Willie Nelson, it's almost a Spanish style. It's also got blues involved. And so, also, if you trace the immigration of Germans and Czechs coming up through Galveston in the 1850s and building these large dance halls that were bigger than any other venues around the country where bands played. And so, in Texas, you had to play louder, you had to play with electricity, you had to bring drums in, all sorts of things. I was really, rather than just have a patchwork of chapters of profiles of artists that I liked, I was looking for the theme, like, about Texas music. What makes Texas music different? What distinguishes it? And that's the thread that ran through all the chapters in this book, which wasn't there in the first book. And I added about 21 different profiles this time. I cut some of them out. In the first book, I had a chapter on Willie Nelson. But, you know, the idea of the book, the True Heroes of Texas Music, is really about unsung heroes of Texas music. It's about giving due to artists who haven't quite got their full due. And I don't think anybody could say Willie Nelson has not got, you know, all the credit for all his great gifts. I mean, he's an amazing artist, but he's been credited. But so what I did for this book, I in the meantime, in 2007, his sister Bobby Nelson, who never does interviews, doesn't look for any publicity at all, she had a solo record, her first solo record. So she was actually doing interviews. And I sat down with her two times for like, you know, an hour and a half each. And they were the greatest interviews I've ever done. I mean, she is just so humble. And just a beautiful, beautiful person who shares so much of you know, her life in the interview. And so I thought, well, why don't I take Willie out and put in Bobby Nelson? Because you can still tell the story of Willie, but you're telling from a different perspective. And she was telling me about how when she was 6 years old and Willie was 4 years old, and their grandparents showed her how to play the Great Speckled Bird on the piano, and they showed Willie the chords on the guitar, and they both started playing together, and they looked at each other, their eyes lit up, and they were playing music together for the first time, and they saw the magic of the music. And to me, something like that is really more enlightening on the whole story. I mean, here's a brother and sister who've been playing together for 80 years. There's nothing like that. You know what I mean? You hear about people that, oh, they've been married for 75 years, whatever. But playing music every day for 80 years, almost every day, to me, that's a greater story.
So I want to touch upon something you said there when it comes to research. You know, you mentioned the larger populations of African Americans and Hispanics, and it immediately made me think of a musician like Flaco Jimenez, you know, who is playing the accordion, which is a very good mixture of that German and Spanish like truism that is San Antonio. Did you see other cases of that like throughout your research? And, you know, was there something in North Texas or West Texas where you wouldn't assume that that type of music was going to maybe take on that tenor of instrumentation, but then it ends up doing so?
Well, I think that the country music influence and the blues in Texas are, you know, pretty much on an equal basis. And I think that in the Mississippi Delta, the blues players did not play country music, but in Texas they did. And partly that's because in the 1920s and 30s, the greatest entertainment out there was cowboy movies, basically, or movies in general. But cowboy movies were big with all races, all sexes, and all ages. And so I think that, and they were all, most of them were set in Texas, too. And so I think that Texans figured they had a lot to live up to. And they had to have a little bit of the cowboy sound. And, you know, that's what Texas was to the rest of the country. That's what sold. Mm-hmm. And so I think the makeup of Texas music is a lot of sharing. And just like I said about the Mexicans sharing the guitars with the blacks in the fields, it's not just, you know, it's all styles of music. You know, the Western swing was really into blues. And, you know, Jack Teagarden, the great trombone player from Vernon, Texas, was influenced by the black Pentecostal church. That's where that informed his playing. And so I think that there was a lot of, it was just basically soaking up influences and trying to forge something new out of those influences, out of the new sound, because you're from Texas and you're supposed to be a pioneer.
Again, I'd like to go back upon something you said there. You mentioned the conversations you had with Bobby Nelson. Some of those were the best interviews you've had, you know.
Yeah.
You've been a critic, a historian, and just a feature writer as well. So you've been in the right places for a lot of moments in music. What really set those interviews apart from a conversation? I mean, you talked to Willie a lot for this book. I mean, I looked in the index and he's referenced in at least 5 or 6 chapters, you know? So what was it about the conversations with Bobby that were just so striking?
Well, they were just so genuine. And it wasn't like she had said them hundreds of times. A lot of times when, you know, musicians, one of the least favorite parts of their job is interviews. You know, they're on the road, they have to do a phone interview, they hate doing them. I have a good friend who's a road manager, and she would say, like, they'd pass the phone to each other, like she was on the road with Pavement. None of them want to do the interview, because they ask the same questions, you know, you're just trying to give them a sound bite. There's really no connection there. With Bobby Nelson, she hadn't done a lot of interviews, and in one case, I interviewed her, and it was at a Farm Aid in New York when they did it at Randall's Island. And she's on the bus with Neil Young and Willie are on the bus, and they're smoking weed. And she says, I just need a break, you know? And so Willie's person, David Anderson, like his body man or whatever, walked us to this abandoned barracks or something. I guess it used to be a base there. And we're all there by ourselves. And for 2 hours, she was just telling me all these incredible stories. And I mean, not incredible stories where you go like, I can't believe that happened, but just, you know, losing her children, having her children taken away because she played in a honky-tonk, and the friction between the Nelson family and the Fletcher family, her husband, you know, her family is well-to-do. And these are all things I didn't know existed, and just how her husband, Bud Fletcher, put her and Willie together in a band. He was like the band leader, even though he didn't play an instrument, and you know, he drank too much, and they had problems with this and there. And these are things that you don't get on a phone interview. You just have to you know, be a good listener. And with Bobby Nelson, I was just so just charmed by everything she was saying that I would listen to her really well. And it was like hearing, it was like interviewing someone from a different era that somehow is still alive.
And I'm sure too, knowing the interview process, sometimes the stories come to life when you're hearing it. So I imagine that moment you brought up where their eyes lit up, that you could almost picture that.
Yeah. And she says something, I use it in my Arizona Drains chapter. I didn't use it in the Bobby Nelson chapter. But she said when she got a piano when she was 6 years old, that she pressed her hands on the keys and she knew she'd never be lonely again. And that's so touching, you know. And then I ended up, like I said, using it for the Arizona Drains chapter, because to me, a blind woman from Sherman, Texas, whose parents were the children of slaves. She had no real life for her, you know, except for the piano. And when she found the piano at the blind school in Austin, you know, it just kind of turned her life around and gave her a new purpose. And so to me, that's the same thing as with Bobby, only in a little more dire conditions with Arizona Drains.
Well, you know, as I mentioned to you, even before we got started here, you know, I was interested in a gentleman who from Waco, and he was a producer who seemed to have worked with everyone, and I had never heard of him. I was doing Google searches while I was reading this book to look for him. Even his Wikipedia page was pretty blank. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about
Tom Wilson.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about Tom Wilson?
One thing about Tom Wilson, and the reason he had a problem with Google searches is because his name is Tom Wilson. It's really hard. I did a lot of research on Willie Johnson, you know, Blind Willie Johnson. If his name was Arizona Drains, it'd be a lot easier, but his name is Willie Johnson. It's really tough. But Tom Wilson is so neglected by history. I don't know why he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I mean, you make the reference Rick Rubin almost, right? He's of that level.
He's of the Rick Rubin, yeah. He's at, because as Rick Rubin, you know, worked with the Beastie Boys, and then he worked with Johnny Cash, and then he worked with Tom Petty, and, you know, then Jake Bugg, and then Adele. He just works with everybody. Well, Tom Wilson, he's a black man from Waco, and he worked with Simon and Garfunkel. He's the one that gave them their first hit with Sound of Silence. They had released it as an acoustic, a folk song, and then they broke up because the album didn't sell. Paul Simon went to England, and so Tom Wilson said, I'm going to put some guitar, I'll put drums, I'll put bass to the song. We'll make it a folk rock song. And when Paul Simon heard about it, he flipped out. He says, no way, you can't do that. And he, you know, by the time he got to back to the States, he had a number one song. And so then Tom Wilson goes from that to producing three of the seminal Bob Dylan albums, Freewheeling, Bring It All Back Home, one of the ones in between that. And he also produced Like a Rolling Stone, and was actually fired after that song was recorded. It was his only song on Highway 61 Revisited. Interesting enough, he was replaced by a guy from Hillsboro, Texas, named Bob Johnston. So you've got from Waco to Hillsboro is about 40 miles, and you have two of the greatest producers of all time working on with all these great people. And I think that after he did Bob Dylan, he went to MGM Records and produced the first two Velvet Underground records, and he produced the first two or three Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention records. So here's a guy who really... He produced The Animals. He made the first record at the Record Plant in New York City, which I'm drawing a blank on the band now, but it was in 1968. Anyway, and I was surprised when I first heard that he was from Texas. You know, Tom Wilson, the producer, I'd seen his name on liner notes. And then when I found out he was a black guy, I thought, well, this is really, we should know about this guy. Why don't we know about him? And so that's really kind of the impetus for a lot of the chapters in the book. It's people that are woefully underrated. You know, and I would even put like Ray Price in there, even though you would think Ray Price is well known, but when you think about it, he basically saved country music not once but twice. And yet he was not inducted to the Country Music Hall of Fame until the 90s. Just ridiculous. And so that's kind of what a music critic does in general, is you're trying to boost up bands that should be better known, and you knock down bands that should be less, you know, regarded.
You know, Texans are often referred to as these entrepreneurs, you know, like they have this entrepreneurial spirit. And it sounds as though that's something that you were able to capture in a lot of the people that you profiled for this book. It may not have been business, but it was, hey, you know what? I love music and I love storytelling, and I'm going to find a way to make this story be told in a way that's authentically Texas. Yeah. Without there being a signature sound, is that unique to in the United States? I mean, because I think people often forget that Texas has the star power it does.
Well, I think there's a lot of states that could have their own book like this. You know, even Minnesota, you know, Bob Dylan, Prince, The Replacements, Husker Du, you know, Mississippi, Elvis Presley, the Delta Blues. I mean, North Carolina and all their bluegrass and all that stuff. But the thing that sets Texas apart is a range, the breadth of all the music. It's not just one style, or it's every type of music there is. And one thing I didn't do in the first book that I did in this book was I had some stuff on jazz. You know, I don't know anything about jazz really, but I kept, when I was doing research, I kept hearing about this Milt Larkin Orchestra out of Houston, came up in the King Curtis. He played with them. But anyway, the Milt Larkin Orchestra name kept coming up. And when I did research on them, I found out that they had, at one point, they had Illinois Jacquette on saxophone, Tom Archia on saxophone, Eddie Cleanhead Vincent. They had Wild Bill Davis, who was really the first guy to play wild organ, you know, before Jimmy Smith. Anyways, it was an all-star band, and they had never recorded together because, you know, first they had the Petrillo band in the early 40s, the union where you couldn't record, and then Milt Larkin was drafted. And so, to me, they're like the greatest band who'd never recorded. And so that's a great story. And then you can talk about, you know, Illinois Jacquette, who really had the landmark Texas tenor recording with Lionel Hampton on Flying Home. And that song really became the template for all the Texas tenors that came afterwards, from, you know, King Curtis and Buddy Tate and Fathead Newman. That was the one solo that really started the whole thing. And when you listen to it now, it sounds really tame, really simple. But back in 1942, it blew minds.
Well, you know, our audience is in Dallas and in the Fort Worth region, you know, and the DFW. And I know for myself, I always find a little bit of pride when I find out, oh, that guy came from right down the street from where I live. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that, Dallas. You used to work at the Morning News.
Yeah.
Who are some of the standouts that you think, hey, you know, Dallas has this person to their name and you should know that?
Well, there's a funny story in the book where Jimmy Vaughn becomes infatuated with the blues, and then he gets a Freddie King record, and on the back of the record it says that Freddie King was influenced by T-Bone Walker. So he gets a T-Bone Walker record, and then it blows his mind, because T-Bone Walker really basically invented the language of electric guitar and the blues. He was the first one to do it. And Charlie Christian, also from Dallas, was the first one to really play jazz on electric guitar with any bit of accomplishment. And so Jimmy Vaughn became this huge T-Bone fanatic. It did not find out till a few years later that T-Bone lived in the same neighborhood as he did. He's from Oak Cliff. He was originally called Oak Cliff T-Bone when he recorded in the late 30s. So that's you know, kind of a cool thing where you find out your idol grew up, you know, just down the road from where you did. But there's so many greats came out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, Lefty Frizzell really changed honky-tonk music out of a recording studio on Ross Avenue. That belonged to Jim Beck. He came in 1950 and recorded If You Got the Money, I've Got the Time, and really invented a new way to singing that everybody's copied, from Merle Haggard and Dwight Yoakam, George Jones, basically anybody who sings with the phrasing, kind of a jazz phrasing in country music. That came from Lefty Frizzell, and that originated in Dallas on Ross Avenue.
You know, it's so often I think people think of country music when they think of Texas. And you know, obviously we have our luminaries. You know, we have Willie Nelson, we have George Strait, we have the Dixie Chicks. I could go on for days and days listing people.
Right.
But the thing that sounds as though you're saying is that the blues are just as impactful to the sound of Texas as country music. And
absolutely.
And it sounds as though that mixture is something that is maybe not easily recognized, but that is just true to the DNA of music in Texas.
Yeah, there's blues in everything. That's what sets Texas music apart. And I think the very first Western swing record was by Prince Albert Hunt from the Dallas area, called Blues in a Bottle, recorded in 1928 in San Antonio. And it's a perfect mix of fiddle music and blues music.
Michael Corcoran is the author of All Over the Map, True Heroes of Texas Music. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Well, thanks, Holly. It's great.